This is file number 14, cycle 2. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is January 21, 2016. I am interviewing Charles Vail Esquire on Mount Riga and personalities on Mount Riga and anything else that I can think of to ask him. And we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
My name is Charles Vail.
With one L.
One L. V-A-I-L. And my father said, V as in Victor.
V as in Victor. V as in victory.
Right.
I've lost my first sheet. Where's my first sheet? What's your birth date?
My birth date, June 27, 1943.
And your birthplace?
In Boston, Mass. The Boston Lying In Hospital.
Your parents' names?
My father was named Alfred Thorburn Vail. And my mother was Frances Dockery Hudson Vail.
Okay, would you spell your father's middle name?
T-H-O-R-B-U-R-N.
And your mother's maiden name?
Frances Dockery, D-O-C-K-E-R-Y, Hudson Vail.
And do you have siblings?
I do. Mary Ann, with an E.
Thank you.
Vail. Lanahan, L-A-N-A-H-A-N. And my younger sister, I'm the oldest in family, my younger sister is Elizabeth Dockery Vail Knight. K-N-I-G-H-T.
Thank you for the spelling.
She's known as Betsy.
Mm-hmm. Your educational background after high school?
After I graduated from high school, I went to Boston College, earned an AB degree in political science, and then a JD at American University in Washington, D.C. Graduated there in 1969.
Well done. Well done. And you said that you came to the area because you met Margie.
I did.
Uh-huh.
I met my wife, Margaret, who's known as Margie, mm-hmm. and always has been, Margie O'Brien, and actually it was Margaret Claire O'Brien, and the Claire is C-L-A-I-R-E, it was named
for the county in Ireland.
For the county in Ireland.
That's what she told me when I did her interview. All right. I'm going to ask you, first of all, to give me some background, physical description and business description of Judge Donald J. Warner, please.
Judge Donald J. Warner mm-hmm. was, well, there were two of them.
I know, but we want the one that was connected with Mount Riga.
Well, they were both sort of connected to Mount Riga, but
well,
the first one who... Margie's uncle used to call old Judge Warner.
That's the one I want.
Well, of course, I never met him because he died long ago. But mm-hmm. apparently, the tradition is that he was a local attorney here in Salisbury mm-hmm. and practiced at the time when the iron industry was sliding downhill and much of his... interest was in Mount Riga because somehow he had acquired a hunting lodge up on the Upper Lake. And he also was very active in trading properties and lending money to colliers who would come through buying a few acres of land, say 10 acres, with the purpose of harvesting all of the trees on that 10-acre piece over a year or so's time. Turning it into charcoal and selling it to the iron industry, which was operating up there. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was known as the Millerton Iron Company at that time. So that Warner, Judge Warner, old Judge Warner, would not only lend the money for the purchase, but he would then buy back the land, which had been stripped of its trees and mm-hmm. had greatly diminished in value without the trees on it. But nevertheless, he would purchase those lots, give the departing collier, a little grub stake for the next purchase. And of course, the collier would have sold a year's worth of timber to the iron company and should have made some money. But this process was repeated to the effect that old Judge Warner had acquired quite a lot of land on Mount Riga, in the Mount Riga range, on the environs. So he was in a position to acquire the main piece when the Millerton Iron Company went broke and declared bankruptcy, and eventually the Warners acquired title to most of what we now know as Mount Riga, including the lakes and the Wacocastinook Stream, by tax sale.
How much property did that?
I don't know how much it was, but it's got to be 2,000 or 3,000 acres.
I had heard somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000.
It could be. Eventually, my first knowledge about the holdings of Mount Riga, it was 5,000 acres. Mm-hmm. And whether all of that related to the Millerton Iron Company, I don't think so.
Perhaps not, but I think that he added pieces.
Right.
And, that was the big piece.
But the Warners effectively controlled the 5,000 acres one way or another.
And when they formed the corporation, there were four families that were...
Three or four, depending on...
Who you talk to.
Yes, who you talk to and what importance they give it. But the Mount Riga Incorporated was formally incorporated in 1923, mm-hmm. It may have been after the death of Donald T. Warner, or shortly before his death. And Donald T. was the grandson of Donald, right. Old Donald J. Donald T. Warner was a prominent lawyer and jurist. He was a member of the Constitutional Convention that rewrote the state constitution in 1902, I believe it was. And was one of a very few number of Superior Court judges at the time.
Would you tell me the three or four families that were initially involved?
It was the Warners who held the land. Mm-hmm. And they may have needed some, what you might say were money partners, to help with the expenses or help with the acquisition or provide funds for a buyout to the family and convert land into cash. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the other two parties were Frank Wells McCabe, who was a Civil War veteran and was related by marriage to the Warners. And the Warners lived in Salisbury and the Wellses lived in Litchfield, and somehow or another the Warners and Wellses got together in this marriage, and
we're going to get to the Litchfield a little later on.
They were cousins, and so that may have provided the entree into the financial relationship. Major Frank Wells, as he was known, was a banker after the Civil War.
I'm going to get to him, but I want that other family.
And the other family was
the Schwabs.
The Schwabs. Right. Who actually are descendants of the Wheeler family in Sharon, and the Wheeler sisters built the clock tower, among other things.
Yep.
They were benefactors, generally. So somehow, and they
were all related.
They're all related, and I believe their money came out of Chicago, mm-hmm. in some sort of industrial concern. It may have been plumbing, and I don't know how that relationship was cultivated. But those were the three families, the Warners, the Wellses, and the Schwabs.
Now we're going to go on to Major Frank McCabe. Tell me about him, please.
Oh, Major Frank Wells was the original.
Mm-hmm.
And he had two children, Frank and his wife, had two children. And so one was Harry Wells. And Harry, I remember meeting Harry Wells. He was in his 90s when I met him, and I went to his 100th birthday party.
Oh, lovely!
Which was celebrated in Brewster, New York.
Mm-hmm.
I had graduated from law school, so it was sometime in 1970 or 80, but in the early 70s. And Uncle Harry had a family of several children, and one of them is Crosby Wells, who's
yep.
alive today.
Yep.
Harry, the other child of that marriage, was Margie's grandmother. And she married Ambrose Farrell McCabe.
And this is where Frank McCabe comes in.
And this
in.
Is Frank McCabe, that Frank Wells McCabe was his name, F.W. Mm-hmm. McCabe. And he was the firstborn of that marriage. So, and then the second child was my mother-in-law, Louise Crosby O'Brien. And of course, that was her maiden name, was yeah. Marie Crosby. Yes, okay. Wells.
I'll get there.
I'm sorry,
Marie. I'll get there.
Let's get to think of her name. It was Louise Crosby McCabe,
mm-hmm.
and she married Robert O'Brien later. And then there were two other children, Ambrose Church McCabe, and the church is because of
Samuel Church.
Samuel Church here mm-hmm. in Salisbury. Mm-hmm. And Lyman Austin Spaulding McCabe.
Yep.
Senior, mm-hmm. because there is a junior. And the senior, Lyman Austin Spaulding, was Mr. McCabe's law partner. So he named his last born son after his law partner.
And that's the son is Mike McCabe, but that's what he goes by, is Mike
Junior.
McCabe. Junior.
Is L.A.S. McCabe Junior,
right.
known everywhere as here as Mike. Or sometimes to some of his friend as Spaulding. His
mm-hmm.
father was known as Spaulding.
Mm-hmm.
So that's roughly the genealogy.
Perfect. Perfect. What was the Mount Riga Educational and Historical Society?
Well, I believe it was the Educational and Historical Foundation, Incorporated. It was a foundation established by Frank Wells McCabe, who by that time had pursued a career in banking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're talking about the 1950s.
Yep.
Frank was president, then chairman of the National Commercial Bank and Trust Company in Albany, New York. He had joined that organization early in the late 20s or 1930s and rose from whatever position he was hired at to lead the bank, and then went on to engineer the merging of that bank with other banks, which eventually became the Key Corporation banks, which are today traded on the New York Stock Exchange and headquartered in Cleveland.
Good heavens.
Ohio. So,
what did this foundation, did it actually come to fruition, and what did it do?
Well, it had two main interests. One was the historical interest, which was focused on the Mount Riga issues, and the principal legacy was the rebuilding of the furnace on top of the mountain.
Ah.
There's a plaque up there to that
oh, yes.
effect, and it was done in the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
and I have seen the photos of it, in which it looks a little bit like a pile of rocks, and by the time they finished it, it had four square sides and a top.
Yeah.
Incidentally, that.
I've seen that same photograph of
yes.
a pile of rocks.
Yes. And curiously, the foundation was dissolved and disbanded in the 1980s, perhaps, because it became disused. First, Frank had died, and mm-hmm. so the principal contributor was no longer able to help fund the activities, and some of which were to provide scholarships for children who needed some financial help to go to college. And they were local kids, and some of them were indeed even related to Frank. So,
not bad.
Right. And I was served as a trustee at that time when I was practicing law in Sharon with Donald Warner. And I was a trustee, and I remember one of the other trustees was Jeffrey Walker from the Salisbury School.
Right.
He served on that board of directors on the foundation, Mount Riga Historical and Educational Foundation Board. So it closed, and it had at one time an interest in a wildlife pond, it was called, but it was an eddy of water near the stone bridge on the Mount Riga Road as it goes up to Mount Riga, and it was part of the Wacko-Castanook water system, ecosystem, and I don't know, frogs and other local
frogs
critters
and colors,
lived in there, but Frank protected about 3 acres so that no one could build around it. And eventually that land, that pond was swapped with the National Park Service when they acquired the Appalachian Trail for some other land that Frank had that went into the Park Service deal.
Okay. You told me when we talked before that you learned 2 valuable lessons from Frank McCabe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was... Frank was... a masterful commander, I would say, on most of a meeting. He had a terrific presence at a business meeting. He was always well prepared. He frequently drafted the agenda by himself, and so he knew the direction of where the meeting was going to go. Mm-hmm. But he was very skilled at bringing people along, building a consensus, and sometimes it was with a soft arm around the shoulder, and other times it was a more forceful sort of way of persuasion. But he was very, very effective, and I learned a great deal from him as a young man about how to be effective in a meeting, and it's a skill that served me well my entire career.
It's a skill that serves many different purposes. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a lawyer, or a teacher, or a volunteer,
whatever. If you're dealing with a group of people and you're asking the group to do something, skill at leading them is absolutely important.
And not always making it obvious that you are leading them.
Right. The best way to do it is convince somebody that your idea is theirs and that they fall in love with it.
Wonderful. Wonderful training. Tell me a little bit about Margie's mother, Louise, please.
Margie's mother, Louise, was a very... I remember the first time I met her. She had a hammer in her hand and was fixing something in an apartment she was redoing in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol Hill neighborhood. Louise became involved in redoing and rehabbing and rehabilitating these old... 2 and 3 story townhouses in the Capitol Hill district of Washington, D.C. And she was a hands-on person. She was a very intelligent woman. She was a Phi Beta Kappa graduate from Smith College in economics. She worked for Senator Wagner in New York and didn't marry until late in life. She was 30, I think.
That was late at that time,
and she had traveled extensively in Europe, spoke German and French, and I had never met anybody who possessed so many skills and could strike a hammer into a nail
and actually hit the nail on the head.
And I remember going home and remarking to my mother and father that this was really an unusual lady. She drove a standard shift car, and it was a Peugeot with Michelin tires, both of which were sort of new to the American taste anyway.
Definitely.
But they threw away the mold when they made Louise. She had been one of those people who were very progressive and had supported Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, and after the war, soured on the whole experience and became very conservative.
But that's
the story of a lot of people in that era.
Yeah, sure.
So that was my introduction to my mother-in-law, was to see her with a hammer. And
pretty forceful.
Yes, but she was a very cultured person. She loved food. She liked wine. She was devoted to Mount Riga. She spent... every year, some part of the year, long weekends up there. And until she died in 1983, she had always spent a great deal of time with Mount Riga and was always involved either herself earlier in her life or through her children and me as her son-in-law mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. the affairs of Mount Raga as the next generation became involved in its activities.
What's the connection with the Litchfield House?
Well, Louise became a widow in the middle 50s, and prior to that, I think when her husband was sick, Margie's father, they had, the couple had wanted to acquire a country house, and Louise's family had come from Litchfield, and that was the Wells family, mm-hmm. and her uncle, in effect, her great uncle, had been brought up in the house in Litchfield, and then, after the Civil War, he had moved to Brewster, New York, which was a railroad, a little railroad town that mm-hmm. became important because East and West railroads sort of crossed there. And it was on the Harlem Division,
yeah.
and not too far from Danbury, so that those railroads came across. Anyway, he built a business career in Brewster, and various cousins and then friends of cousins occupied the Litchfield House. Well, by the time of the 1950s rolling around, it was in fractional ownership, and the Wells family owned at least half of it, and the McCabe family wanted to acquire the other half, so it was a matter of going around and getting 16ths and 8ths put together.
No.
But they did it, and Louise's husband, of course, was a lawyer, so we understood the process. And Uncle Frank and McCabe and Uncle Harry, who was great-uncle Harry, Louise's Uncle Harry, Margie's great-uncle Harry, all helped in getting the title to Louise. And she then set about rebuilding the house and modernizing it, and lived there for some time, sort of lived between Washington, D.C. and Litchfield and
Mount
Raga.
Where was the house located in Litchfield?
It's located on East Street. Okay. In the business of the Wells family, when they built it, well, they were millers, so it was located on the Bantam River.
Oh, all right.
Mm-hmm. And there were several little mill sites there. They were wool millers and also some sort of flour mill, and it's opposite the what a lot of people call the food locker, which was
I know where
the
it is.
Street from the old homestead house.
Yeah, okay.
So,
all right, we're going to switch from personalities now to the property. Would you tell me about the time in the 50s when Connecticut, the state of Connecticut, wanted to take the Mount Riga property and form a state park?
Well, of course, I wasn't involved in that, but I recently read newspaper articles from the New York Herald Tribune about this development. There was a proposal to develop a tri-state park, which would involve an expansion of the newly formed Taconic Park Commission, which Robert Moses had influenced in either its founding or its expansion. And, of course, the Taconic Parkway was all part of this vision of creating greenways for city people to escape the city and come up to the country and enjoy a day, a week, whatever it took, to enjoy public-owned and public access to parkland. So the idea was that New York State would, through the Taconic Park Commission, acquire hundreds or thousands of acres on the New York State side, and that Massachusetts had a state forest, I guess they didn't have a state forest, but there was land available for purchase or could have been condemned in the very southwest corner of the state of Massachusetts in the town of Mount Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody lived there. I mean, there's only 140 people live there now.
159.
Okay. And they are trying to get internet service. But back in the 50s, it was even more sparsely populated. And was, interestingly, there's the remnants of a few of them where there were guest houses. They were sort of like small hotels where people would come and spend a couple of weeks, and there was, you wouldn't call it second home ownership, but it was places where people came and sojourned for a little while, enjoyed the mountain air. No particular lake to swim in or anything, but that...
But they had Bash Bish Falls, and they had hunting and fishing.
That's true. Hunting, fishing, hiking, and blueberry picking.
Oh, very definitely. Yeah.
And so it was a way to get away. And then, of course, Mount Raga had assembled through the Warners and on forward through the corporation 5,000 acres. So that was in the crosshairs of the planners thinking of this park commission. So the local people in Salisbury, including their representative, Jake Rand, heavily mobilized. At that time, every town had an equal number of representatives. And this was before the one man, one vote decision in 1963, I think that was. So, Map versus Ohio. No, that was a different case. Anyway, doesn't matter. The locals organized a very strong objection to spending state money for land way out in the sticks that was not developed and nobody would be able to get to it. It wasn't. The vision was such that it didn't have the sizzle of beachfront property down on the shore or things like Bear Mountain in New York. It was beautiful, but it was quite remote from population centers. When you think about Hartford and Albany, and maybe perhaps Poughkeepsie being the largest centers of population, it died of its own weight. But it was certainly a wake up call for the Mount Raga community, which could hardly afford to mount a defense on its own. It just didn't have the money to do that. So the Mount Raga folks were grateful to the political leadership of the town of Salisbury and the local communities in taking the fight up for them. And
is this where the story comes in about Dan Brazy taking his pet deer to Hotfoot?
Could have been.
According to Mike McCabe, the locals were really upset about this, and so Dan Brazy put his pet deer, Bambi, in the truck, and they drove to Hartford.
That might have been. I mean, Dan would have been that age.
Yep.
And he would have been, Danny would have been 7 or 8 or 9 years old, so that could have been exactly what happened.
And he, you know, if you...
I'd never heard that story.
Oh, you hadn't? Oh, if you make this into a park... wildlife like Bambi are going to lose their home, and I guess it was a real sob story, and it worked.
I suspect the real reason it worked was there wasn't the heart to spend the money to acquire.
With all probability, that's the hard truth. But the other story about the deer is pretty good, too.
The story about the deer is wonderful and heart-tugging, but also trying to get three states, we still suffer from it, trying to get cooperation on any kind of regional project with three towns or three states is a monumental task.
Let's go on to the next, I'm going to say land grab, with the Appalachian Trail, and this happened in the 80s.
Right.
Tell me about that, please.
Well, the negotiations opened in the 70s with Mount Raga because the National Park Service had worked with a quasi-government organization that was formed after something called the National Trails Act was passed by Congress. And that, I'm not sure the origin of that, but it could have been as early as Lyndon Johnson, but if not, it was through the Richard Nixon administration that they had finally, I guess, formed a commitment that the federal government was the only governmental agency capable of organizing the acquisition of the Pacific Coast Trail and the Appalachian Trail being the two most prominent long-range trails, both of which were built during the Depression with the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Well done.
And then sort of was taken under the wing of all of the various private hiking organizations, the principal one being the Appalachian mountain club here in the East. But there, again, they were a volunteer organization. There were a lot of people, but many of them were financially well-fixed, but the idea of acquiring thousands and thousands, and or really millions of acres from Maine to Georgia was too prodigious a task, even for a well-funded organization. So the national legislation came on the scene, and then it was only a matter of, well, when would the funding happen so that land acquisitions could actually begin? And when would the political commitment go forward from the Park Service to actually hook up all of the various parts of the trail? And not to go into the history of the trail, but there were many parts of it that went through state forests and had been dedicated to trail use, but then there were lots of other parts that connected these two pieces, and they needed to be protected, and some were subject to degradation from hiking because of development. And so, lo and behold, at least as far as we were concerned, by the late 1970s, the Park Service had built up a bureaucracy and staff to go out and get the job done, and they started working their way in the New York and Connecticut area, and eventually into Massachusetts. And so there was a simultaneous bunch of negotiations with landowners in all three states to sort of put together the trail. And we were, because we own 5,000 acres and over 3 miles of trail, we were an obvious target for negotiations. And so, again, Frank McKay was then leading the company, Mount Raglan, I mean. And when we first were approached, there were many people, former leaders and members of the board of directors, who, remembering the 1953 fight, were resistant to any sort of government intrusion into Mount Raglan. They thought that we would lose control and would simply become a park, and people from elsewhere would overrun the mountain and spoil the wonderful experience that many of them had had as children and adults. Mm-hmm. So Frank was more forward-thinking than simply reacting that way, and even though he had been involved in the resistance to the 1953 takeover, he sort of led the company and its directors, and with a little bit of help from me, into thinking about having a constructive dialogue to fully understand what the position was of the acquisition team from the of the Park Service. Well, it turned out that when they spread out the maps and the surveys that they had done, that they weren't interested in acquiring the whole place. They really wanted perhaps 100 foot on each side of a corridor, a couple hundred feet wide, the length of the trail. So that would have involved several hundred acres, but it would have sliced our landholding on the east side of the Mount Washington Road into two halves. And we then made the bold step of saying, well, why don't you acquire everything to the east of the trail? Because that would give you the ultimate protection against the future intrusion of housing and other things. And they jumped on it. And it very quickly came to an agreement, including a price, which was $1,000 an acre, which at the time we thought was extremely generous, and it certainly was a higher price than we thought we could get if we had sold 1,000 acres. So we wound up with over $1 million as a result of the sale. That solved the financial problems of the corporation, which had been severe. Prior to that, I think the company had less than $25,000 in assets. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we had more than $1 million.
Not bad.
And so it's enabled the corporation to, from 1984, which is now 35 years to have to manage its holdings in a way that's appropriate, to pay taxes and keep the place up, including making a major dam repair.
Oh, that was a big one.
All of this has been possible.
It was a win-win
because of the
situation.
Negotiation with the Appalachian Trail. It was win-win.
Now I'm going to move on to some personal things. You have a wonderful story about going to Tanglewood in 1969.
Yes, this is...
And I want both parts of the story, please.
Okay. Well, I remember that because Frank McCabe had been very generous to Margie and to me. Margie was his niece. And in fact, when Margie died, when Margie's father died, Frank took Margie in along with his daughter, who was a bit younger, into his home. And the girls went to school at an academy in Albany. But this allowed Margie's mother to go get an education certificate and enabled her to get a job as a teacher.
Well, that was very generous of him.
It was. So Margie and Uncle Frank had a long-standing niece-uncle relationship, and Uncle Frank seemed to take to me as her young husband.
I can understand why.
But he was... I enjoyed my relationship with Uncle Frank. Many people my age had difficulty with him, but I think I understood a little bit more what made him tick and his ambition and his skill.
And you
appreciated, of course, he wasn't a person without faults.
But you appreciated what he could give you as a tutor.
And we also had similar interests. I mean, I enjoyed classical music. He found that out, and all of a sudden, Margie and I would be getting tickets to Tanglewood, because the bank that he worked for, I'm sure through his influence, had purchased a box, which was six seats, for every performance.
Mm-hmm.
He went as often as he wanted to with his wife, Mary Lee, and their friends, and I'm sure business entertaining took place as well. But there were still times when the seats would go begging, and we were often offered the seats, and usually had the time and energy to take advantage of it. So in 1969, we had no children, and we were offered seats to go to Tanglewood. And the first memory was that this was at the time of the moon launch. And
that's the one I'm looking for.
Yeah, and we were there with people in... My mother-in-law, Margie, my mother-in-law, Louise, one of her friends, Gertrude was her name, and Gertrude Cancellari, a friend from White Plains, and two younger people who were, one of whom was Gertrude's daughter, I believe her name was Denise, and that would have made...
the Moore lady.
One, and, oh yes, and... Sheila, I guess. So, Sheila Moore, who was then... Sheila Moore, who may not have been married yet. But anyway, so we were all there. Margaret Lawler. Yes, Sheila's sister, that's who it was. So we were all sitting there. It was a bit of a rainy day. The concert began, unusual, at 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the evening, or... And in Sunday afternoon, and I remember what was played was a Tchaikovsky Fifth Symphony and a Fifth Violin Concerto, and the violinist at the Violin Concerto was Itzhak Perlman, who was introduced as a new Israeli phenomenal violin player, and he certainly was.
Oh, yes.
So... it troubled me, and just as an aside, it troubled me for a long time. I couldn't remember who that fellow was, except that I enjoyed his performance. And then, in the last few years, Tanglewood put their into all their programs online. And so I went back to the date because I knew from the moon launch what date it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to figure out the date of the performance, and then I looked at the program and I said, oh my God. That's who it was. I just remember him as a pretty fantastic, enthusiastic young violin player, but it turns out it was no less than except permanent. So what happened then was we were seated there, and I believe during intermission, a man in with white gloves, that's what I remember principally, and a silver tray, there's a name for that, but I forgot.
Silver?
Yeah. He came with an invitation for the family to Frank, he asked if this was Frank McCabe's box. My mother-in-law, I think going to her Smith training, says, yes, we are the family of Frank McCabe. So he delivered the note, and inside of it contained an invitation to come to a reception and small recital at the home of Mrs. Kuzovitsky, the wife of Serge Kuzovitsky, mm-hmm. who was the longtime music director of Tanglewood, at their cottage, which was a big place known as Saranac, overlooking the
Stockbridge Bowl.
The Stockbridge Bowl. Mm-hmm. And so we said, yes, of course we'd go up. And I remember I thought this was great. Louise had done just the right thing. Margie felt uncomfortable because she thought she was misrepresenting that we weren't really invited. And, of course, I tried to convince her that...
Of course you were.
Mrs. Kuzovitsky didn't know who Frank McCabe was anyway, so wouldn't be disappointed if he showed up or his family showed up. And this was just one of those things that organizations did to their cultivate their donors. So anyway, we showed up and we shook hands in a receiving line with this very diminutive, tiny little woman who welcomed us and told us that there would be a concert and hoped that we would stay to hear it. And in the meantime, please have wine and things.
Mm-hmm. Wine
so,
and
that's what we did. And we went out and looked over the whole cottage, and there was actually sort of, it was a remarkable experience, because even though it was raining, you could just imagine all the famous musicians who had been there. And I believe Tanglewood now, I know that Tanglewood now owns the place.
Yes, they do.
They bought it.
Yeah, they do.
And it's still a spectacular site, and it's wonderful.
So and it's still used for private receptions,
yes.
too.
Yes. And our other story about that really was that the conductor, Eric Leinsdorf, the concert may have finished around 4 o'clock, and he took his bows when the concert was over and asked the orchestra to get up and be acknowledged, and came and went a couple of times, and then he came out with his hands in the air, which is very unusual to see a conductor do anything, and he brought... A microphone was brought to him, which, of course, in those days didn't have a cord.
Oh, yes.
So it was wired. And he said in slightly German-accented English that he wanted to make an announcement that the men had landed safely on the moon and that the orchestra wanted to play the national anthem. Everyone stood up and listened to the national anthem. It was a very moving thing. And so from there we went sort of stiffened with our patriotic pride in what had happened up to see Mrs. Kuzovitsky.
Not bad.
Not bad. Really a memorable day. Fantastic day.
And didn't you, when you went back up on the mountain,
so the next part of that story is that we left the Kuzovitskys and went home, and we had learned on the radio and the trip home that the astronauts would exit the launch vehicle on the moon sometime around 9 or 10 o'clock. So Margie and I, we heard that that the Bordens, which was Mary Lee's, McCabe's brother, who had built a cottage through Frank's help and influence on the Upper Lake, and had wired the place with electricity, much to the concern of most of the other residents, and had a generator. But on this night, it was welcome because he had a television, and it was the only place with a television on Mount Riga. And so Margie and I took a canoe and paddled across to the Borden camp, and the moon was out, and it was moon bright on the lake, and we got over there, and there was, must have been 25 or 30 people at the Borden house, with the television having been moved out of wherever it was and put in a place of prominence next to the fireplace. And we all just sat there talking and buzzing around as a bunch of people would do, but watching the TV all the time. And then when the announcers, and it may have been Walter Cronkite, came out and said that they're ready to depart, there was hushed in the room. There was no talking, no total silence. And we all just sat there thinking of what was happening. And then Margie and I got in the canoe and went home and looked up at the moon, and we just, you really couldn't understand it in any, you knew what had happened, but
it just
didn't figure how we were here in a place that normally had no electricity, but we had found the one outlet that did. And we're looking up at the moon, and the United States had put a man on the moon. It was just this total contrast of history and experience. There were a lot of things like that in the late 60s.
Oh yeah.
So it was in a way it was just, in a way, as unusual as it was, well, what else did you expect to happen? I mean, it was change. There was just so much change going on, so many good and bad things happening. You just began to expect that every year, almost every month, that some revolutionary change would happen, and you had to get used to it. So that was so that our memory of that is sort of colored by the relative lack of change, the relative lack of change, although over 30 years, a great many things have happened, but not at the same sort of pace as it seemed to be happening in the 60s, or maybe it was just us. Maybe we were
I think there was a lot going on in the 60s.
Yeah, it was.
But that was a remarkable day.
But that's a way, that was an incredible way to sort of close out that was the summer of 1969, to sort of close out the decade. Mm-hmm. And Margie and I had both started college. We met in 1962, so for us it was the beginning of our relationship, and by the time the decade had run out, we were on the moon.
And not bad.
In another year, we started having children. So
that was an entirely
different adventure.
All right. The last question, a formal question that I have, is I want to ask you about people's attitude and lifestyle to Mount Riga, and I'd like to start with your mother. What was her attitude toward Mount Riga?
Yes, my mother. My mother grew up in the South and grew up on land that had been settled by her family in the 1770s. They got a land grant from the king.
Yeah,
it was open for the place she came from, Richmond County, named after
Duke of Richmond.
Yes, Duke of Richmond. And lived in a place called Rockingham, which is named after another prominent English lord. Mm-hmm. So they had been there through good times and bad. And my mother was a teenager in the... My mother was born in 1913. So by 1930, she was 17 years old. And her father had suffered from rheumatic fever. By that time, he had lost two farms and a sawmill business.
Ooh.
And the family was... There were no roads. There was no electricity yet. And the whole experience there was they were, as we would say today, going down the tubes quickly.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was second oldest of, she had five brothers. So she fibbed about her age. I told us at the congregation at her funeral, she, perhaps her only great fault was fibbing about her age to get into nursing school, and went off to Winston-Salem to the Baptist Hospital and got a nursing degree there and began her professional life as a nurse, and that's in a way how she met my father and all of that. So when it was time to introduce Louise O'Brien and my mother and father, because Margie and I were, our relationship was heading toward getting married, we tried to think of a way and a place to do it. And Litchfield made some sense. Louise was living there, and then we could go up and see the mountain, which is something that I had talked about to my parents a great deal. And we needed sort of a venue, and my father had played football for Villanova, and so he was a college football fan. My mother didn't care much about sports at all. But as fate would have it, Boston College, my school, was playing Army at West Point in October. And so it wasn't too bad a trip for my mom and dad. And it was about the same distance for Louise and Margie and I. So we decided we'd all go to a football game and go back to Litchfield and enjoy things. And so we did. And then the next day we went up to the mountain. And it must have been a long weekend.
Yeah.
Because we spent another day. And my mother was up there. And we were up at the cabin. And there were no toilets. There was an outhouse available. And it was a chilly night. And so we had a fire in a Franklin stove. Mm-hmm. And sometime later, we were talking about going up to the mountain. And my mother said, "You and Margie really like it up there," and we said, "Of course, yes, we love Mount Wagon and all the people there, and don't you, Mom?" And my mother, who was always very candid, but never hurtful, mm-hmm. said, "Well, it's just, to me, it reminds me too much of when I was a girl, and I don't think I would really enjoy it. I sort of moved along from there."
But it was very diplomatically said.
Very diplomatically said. And when Louise heard about that, she understood that completely, because Louise had worked with Senator Wagner and during the Depression, and the whole issue of poverty and mm-hmm. starvation.
Mm-hmm.
The Depression was a really
bad
event.
It was worse
than any of the financial hiccups we've had in our time. And
well, my husband went through the Depression, so did my parents.
Yes, and many people who did, it changed their life. Their mm-hmm. attitudes never wavered from, mm-hmm. If they succeeded in getting through it, it was one of the formative events of that time, of that whole generation.
And their children.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
It had a lot of influence on their children.
Right, and the reaction, and including the reaction, the sort of anti-reaction to the Depression
mm-hmm.
era.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it was a very fundamental thing, and I always remember thinking about my mother's, it was completely understandable to me, because we had grown up in opulent circumstances by comparison. But I knew what she meant. I mean, when I would go visit her mother, my grandmother, I mean, the outhouse was still out in the back, and there was only one indoor toilet. And I remember when that was put in. It was put in 1953. So
mm-hmm.
in my earliest recollection, there was no outhouse. There were chamber pots in the room and a toilet
mm-hmm.
in the back. So when Mom said she didn't really appreciate that anymore, she'd moved beyond that, I knew what she meant.
I think I know the next one, but what's Margie's attitude to the mountain?
Oh, well, I mean, she grew up there as a child and spent every summer there. And she's fond of saying, they left the day after school was out, and they didn't come back until Labor Day was over. And they spent the whole summer up there, and if Margie's mom wasn't there, there was a surrogate parent or a nursemaid or somebody hired to keep her on the kids and see that they were fed. And there was, you got the impression that it was in the 50s, that it was just like all the suburban communities you read about, with streets full of kids playing baseball in the streets and games and flashlight tag and all of that. It was writ large, just like that on the mountain, except you had the advantage of the lakes and the boats and the running around at night. And Margie still talks about being able to walk from the upper lake to the lower lake, which is nearly a mile, and knowing exactly where you were without a flashlight and in bare feet. Ooh. By knowing what you were treading on, whether you were walking over pine needles or sand or muck or pebbles or rocks. She would know where you were. And so that's just one of those experiences. It's an embrace of the primitive, mm-hmm. that is unusual today.
Yeah, very.
And it's interesting to see how our wired grandchildren...
I would go into the next one now. Right. Your children and your grandchildren, what's their attitude?
Well, our children embrace the... By that time, it was not simply an absence of a luxury. For example, I'll use a toilet. You know, not having a toilet in Margie's day was... A lot of people didn't have toilets in rural communities. And particularly if you were up on a mountain camp like that, it was more camping than summer living, because the buildings were very simple and many of them were not very elegant. And the idea was that you were camping, you even had camp cots, and it was like going away to camp, and the reason you had a roof over your head was to keep the rain out of your bedding. But things have, you know, moved along, and the Mount Ragged camps now are a little more luxurious, and they have more amenities. And so by the time our children came along, the oldest born in 1970, I must say that Margie and her women cousins, Linda McCabe and then the other McCabe family, the other cousins, Ellen, that, and other people on the lower lake, those women were not working generally in the summertime, so they continued to spend summers up there and this time with their children. The husbands were working, and so you had packs of kids, all the same age, running around, playing baseball, playing flashlight tag, playing Monopoly, enjoying, you know, being in the lake, literally, for 8 hours a day, breaking for lunch and dinner, and preserving some of the Mount Rainier rules, like no playing baseball after 6 o'clock at night, so the adults would have a chance to enjoy the peace and quiet of the place. So the kids embraced all of that, and even though they had tape players, not CD players, but tape players that ran with batteries, the one change I would say from my experience with Margie as a young couple, we had a lot of gatherings on the mountain. Frank Collin, for example, who was known as Bim Collin, would play the banjo or guitar. Guests would come up, and they were banjo players, guitar players, or singers, and there were piano players. And some of the older women who grew up in the 20s and 30s knew all the old American Standard songs.
Oh, sure.
And would play them on a piano. And the trouble was you couldn't find a piano that stayed in tune.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of live music and a lot of singing and a lot of drinking. By the time my kids' generation arrived, it had moved from that, because no one seemed to play very well, or at least not want to play in front of their peers. And so all of the music was taped, recorded, run by batteries. There was still drinking, which they weren't supposed to be doing, and some of them smoking weed.
No.
So But the fundamental idea of getting together with your friends and enjoying music, and having that kind of recreation in a place that was not that was very primitive and had outside toilets and all of that. There was no fundamental difference. It was just difference of how it was expressed.
How about the grandchildren?
Well, the grandchildren, it's essentially the same, except the toys have changed. And now, of course, it's not a matter of keeping a store of AA batteries around so that your tape player can play. In fact, they're not AA batteries. They were all powered with C and D batteries. And those are hardly used anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, and everyone had flashlights back in my day, back in my children's day, and now they have flashlights, but they're LED things.
Yeah.
And so the technology changed, and the young grandchildren all have iPhones.
Oh, yeah.
And games that can be played. But they'll, you know, when they all get together, it's very remarkable. They still, the most popular game is not a bunch of kids sitting around in a room, each one tuned into their own game, is actually playing Monopoly.
Good.
So that they have a sense somehow, and I think it's because their parents and grandparents have mm-hmm. encouraged it, that when they're on the mountain, it's playing baseball, it's playing flashlight tag, it's playing Monopoly, and all of those things, and doing pancakes on Sunday morning, mm-hmm. and all of the communal things that really make the mountain a special place.
Oh, how wonderful. Before we close, is there mm-hmm. anything that you would like to add to this interview that I haven't asked about?
No, except that, you know, this process of recollecting and thinking back makes me understand how privileged I am to have been affiliated with the place since 1962. So that's it's more than 50 years, and I had no right to be up there except I married the right girl.
You married the right girl.
For fun.
And may it continue.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
All right.